You're listening to Love and Revolution Radio, covering the heart of change and changes of the heart, featuring stories of ordinary, extraordinary people who are waging struggles for love and revolution.
This week on Love and Revolution Radio, we speak with Dr. David Ragland about the truth-telling project for Ferguson and beyond, and the work of collecting, speaking, and disseminating less-heard narratives and pieces of the truth as part of the work of ending racism, police brutality, and systemic injustice.
We were looking at testimony from various truth commissions around the world, and one of the common features was that it presented people's experiences in ways that connected with hearts, making people want to change their society. And that's what truth telling is. How do we connect with hearts that touch minds so that people can be made aware of the conditions that other people live in?
Hello, this is Sherry Mitchell for Love and Revolution Radio. Kwe Agwanu, hello and welcome. I'm coming to you today from my home in the Dawnland in Bunawabskeag Territory, which is located in and along the shores of the beautiful Penobscot River in central Maine, here in Wabanaki Territory. It is icy and cold here today, but the sun has been shining intermittently, brightening the day just a bit, just enough to make it welcoming. And as always, I'm joined by my wonderful co-host, Ms. Rivera Sun. Hello, Rivera.
Greetings, Sherry, and we are in the thick of the new year. I always find that the first weeks of January just fly by so quickly. It's like the world just races off into a new year while I'm still kind of getting over colds and kind of wishing it was still the holidays and reluctantly concluding that, yes, the challenges of our times are real and they are very present again. And it's time to gather our good friends, get together our best skills and knowledge, and get into the fray, into the thick of things, but in a way that engages our heart and engages our sustainable, grounded practice of understanding that the change that we're seeking, hey, it might happen overnight, but there's so much of it that we're going to be engaged with this process of transformation for quite some time. So let's do it with the best of our capacity and let's find out the best skills for doing it. Which brings us to today's guest, David Ragland. Now, David Ragland is the co-director of the Truth Telling Project, which is a truth initiative for Ferguson and beyond. He is also on the board of the Fellowship of Reconciliation and the Peace and Justice Studies Association, two great organizations that are also doing powerful and profound work out there in the world. One of the things about having him on this show is that I've been following his initiative and the project. The subject matter is vitally important for today's times. But it also draws on a legacy and a growing field of these kind of initiatives and adds to it and takes it further. It's a great example of how we, too, in our own lives can learn and adapt what's come before us so that we can leave something for those who are coming after us that helps them meet the injustices and transform the injustices that we face. David, welcome to today's show. Thank you so much. We are honored to have you with us, and we are excited for this conversation.
Thank you. I'm honored to be here.
David, let's jump right in. As you and I both know, and Rivera knows, and many of our listeners know, that the first step in reconciliation is truth. Now, we have to be able to tell the truth as it is from every perspective in order to even move toward reconciliation. One of the things that the truth-telling project does is to support reconciliation for the purpose of eliminating structural violence and systemic racism. Can you talk to us a little bit about where the idea for this project came and how it came to be?
We essentially started this project right after Michael Brown was killed in August of 2014. And at the time, I was a faculty member at Bucknell University, and it was right before school was about to start. And I decided to come to St. Louis because August the 9th is the day that Michael Brown was killed, but it's my mother's birthday and my nephew's birthday. And so I come to St. Louis, I think, just to get like a break, because I've been teaching over the summer. Actually, I took a group of students to D.C. to essentially observe and learn from the protests that were going on in front of the Israeli embassy. But when I got to St. Louis that day, I was talking about the Israeli incursion into Palestine to my friends. And what they told me was, we have our own occupation happening in this city. And then right then, my friends and I went out in the streets. And a few weeks later, I ended up staying much longer and even teaching remotely from Ferguson. And in front of my parents' house, Kajimi Powell was killed. And I remember standing outside and getting a call from a colleague who asked me, what are you doing out there? You're a peace and conflict studies practitioner, faculty. And right then I was like, what am I doing? And I had just been going out to protest, being a part of it. But, you know, that academic came out and I was interviewing people, and we ended up beginning the project as a space for people to share dialogue and their experiences, believing that the dialogue would begin getting people to think more deeply and even formulate various strategies to address what is an endemic or epidemic of violence across our country. And that transformed into multiple people meeting weekly by conference call around the country. And the ideas, in addition to the community dialogues that came forward, was truth and reconciliation. What would that look like? Could that be a political and educational intervention? And many people in the community were uncomfortable with the notion of leading with reconciliation, or reconciliation even in the title of the project, because the conversation was reconcile with who? You know, like, there's the expectation for Black folk to forgive when there's violence perpetrated against us. But truth was important. And how does truth get us to structural transformation that's necessary for reconciliation to happen? In addition, most truth and reconciliation processes are after the formal end to a conflict, and police violence is continuous. And so every time a person of color is killed, folks are re-traumatized because it's a reminder of the continuous yoke of oppression that continues through generation. And so rather than offering forgiveness, we wanted to, number one, expand the understanding of reconciliation, because reconciliation is a deep concept. And we wanted, as a project, that to be part of the discourse. But we also wanted to acknowledge what community members wanted. And so we created a quasi-truth commission that was responding directly to people's voices who were not heard, and to create this alternative space where people could tell their stories, so they could essentially tell their own experiences without being mediated from an academic like me or from the media. But also, I think we were building, and we continue to try to build, a kind of political efficacy in our communities, but educate our societies. So we started doing these hearings, which communities came together and witnesses from around the country and respected community elders listened to folks like Sandra Bland's sister came. Michael Brown's sisters testified and his father testified, and many other people who you haven't heard about, whose family members were killed by police. And what we found was that those testimony, those stories, they revealed deeper traumatization as a result of intergenerational trauma, poverty, violence that internally happened in our community, and that was a result of structural oppression and just the way the society operates.
David, one of my questions that I have about the truth-telling project is it seems that it has a profound impact on the participants, those who are recording the stories. And then also there's a profound experience for those who are telling the stories, telling their truth. And then there's a third arena as well of those who are hearing the stories. And I'm wondering, who hears the stories?
That's a good question. When we launched the first hearing, which was in November of 2015, after we had prepped for that year and we met with folks who had created the Greensboro Truth and Reconciliation Commission, we launched an additional program called Night of 1,000 Conversations, as well a project called Living Room Conversations. So the Night of 1,000 Conversation is a direct take from the Greensboro Truth and Reconciliation Commission, where there was a play about the Greensboro Massacre. And I don't know if you all know about, in the late 70s, activists, community activists, civil rights activists were shot at. I think 2 to 3 were murdered by a neo-Nazi group, which we found out later through testimony in their commission that the police of Greensboro had been complicit in sharing the parade route with neo-Nazis. And the result of that was that the community where the protest happened and the people who organized the protest were actually targeted by police, and their perspectives were not believed up until the Truth Commission. But the conversations happened in maybe 2 decades later. And that conversation happened around the city. So we decided that we would record testimony and we would stream them to communities around the country. And so on November the 15th and the 16th, over 20 communities around the country, and most of these groups were white folks, gathered, listened, and we provided a facilitator guide and learning objectives and conversation guide so that people can take a look at the testimony and formulate their own actions after reflection of how they would contribute to reducing the conditions that create this kind of violence in our communities. And then the living room conversations actually began before we started the hearings. And we essentially had communities, mostly white communities, talk about particular issues and have conversations that they wouldn't normally have in mixed company. People self-censor themselves and never get clarification on what hurts people or some of the core understandings that people who do this kind of work have. So I think in general, while we speak internally to our own community, we also reach out to other communities, prioritizing voices that aren't believed as truthful in our media, even though people are believe that their own experience is true. When it comes to folks who've been victimized, victims are often rarely believed.
I think that there are so many things that are similar between what you're talking about and the realities that I faced growing up as a Native woman and the ignorance that's associated with it. One of the things that we've talked about at length on the show and in other forums is the fact that so many people are unaware that these things are happening, that they turn a blind eye to it. And then when they see it on the news, like you're saying, the stories aren't believed, people can't believe it, creates this kind of cognitive dissonance amongst people whose reality is far removed from the violent reality that's being faced by the people targeted. This reminds me of this newspaper ad that ran in a major South Dakota newspaper several years ago, where they had a full-page ad. It was a proclamation regarding Indian hunting season fees, saying that due to shortages of deer, turkey, elk, and antelope, that they would be instead having open season on the Sioux reservations, where they would be killing Indians, and that, you know, they called them worthless red bastards, dog eaters, prairie niggers, and set this whole thing about what the trapping regulations would be, including using alcohol and liquor because of the stereotypes of the drunken Indian. And this wasn't done 60 years ago. This was done fairly recently. And so when you have people that come face to face with this type of hatred, where you have a public newspaper that's willing to run an ad like this, and when they were approached, they said, oh, we have no idea who did it. It was done anonymously, but they still chose to run it in their newspaper, trying to disavow any knowledge of it. So when you have these types of attitudes, these types of beliefs that still run rampant within the public domain, it's hard to address a singular issue because there is no singular issue. This is a multidimensional problem. When the UN's decided that it was going to address minority issues, one of the things that they talked about was the need for it to be multidimensional, the need to educate the public about what they don't know, the need to try to move beyond some of this cognitive dissonance and this embedded racism, because we have two groups of people who for 17 centuries, the white population was led to believe were less than, were subhuman in order to be able to justify conquest and slavery, genocide and slavery. And so when you are trying to undo 17 centuries of embedded thinking and address the contemporary issues that are attached to that, how do you begin that incredible task of educating the public and trying to get people to understand that the problems are real, that these aren't things of the past, that it would be much easier to forget those things, as you said, if they weren't continuously recurring? There's a continuous recurrence of these types of things all over this country, and we've seen an upswing in it in relation to the most recent electoral politics. And so, you know, I guess my question is, what are the multidimensional approaches that need to be taken in order to legitimize those stories, in order to humanize those faces, and in order to address the much deeper embedded racism that exists at the core of the founding of this country?
That's a brilliant question and observation. One of the things that Betty Riordan said to me right before we started the truth-telling project was that we needed a decade of truth and reconciliation, because racism, like the air that we breathe, is embedded in every institution. And in part, I think that we need serious funding, number one, to show people, like, you know, the same way that people are using media, like they took out that ad in the newspaper, we ought to be taking out ads in newspapers. But I caution that particular approach, I think, is part of it. But I think that we have to address some of the core issues. And I think 2017 is, I want to say, the 50th anniversary of King's anti-war speech. In it, he described the triple evils of militarism, racism, and capitalism. And he described these three concepts as connected. And I think that capitalism is essentially one of the core problematics that creates relationships of disparity and inequity, where allowing a newspaper to actually say that, look, you know, this is our business, you know, this is what we do, and we can have this ad, even if it's racist. And so capitalism is presented as a valueless system, or a system that values democracy. And it doesn't necessarily value democracy. Actually, it doesn't, at least the way that it's practiced in our society, or the popular way of practicing it. There are values, and those values are indifference to racism, indifference to bigotry. And so I think at an early level, we should be educating our learners for values of empathy, cross-cultural understanding, and we should be explicit about what's happening in our society at a young age, so that our learners can actually see what's happening in their society, because it's a reflection of the world they're going to inherit. And often people enter the world without an understanding of the world, but steeped in a set of ideologies and perspectives that are narrow and rooted in a bubble, not of what people experience. And so that's why many youth are dissatisfied with the way society is. But you talked about like the longevity of this oppression. And one of the things that David Anderson Hooker said in a speech in Denver maybe a few months ago was that we should view this current political crisis as part of a long march. But particularly, if we look at a supernova, when it dies, it shines the brightest. And he argued that these values are dying because this generation, along with the internet and technology, while they're negative things, are more connected in a way and trying to find truth out for themselves. But at the same time, people are seeing what they're attached to as these indispensable values, but they're values of bigotry and disconnectedness, or ruining somehow some kind of idealized way of life that marginalized women, Black folk, indigenous people, other people of color, LGBTQ brothers and sisters. And so out of fear, which is part of that attachment to this way of life, people have a hard time in dispensing with it. And I do believe that we'll see in the next few years how that doesn't work for anyone. And I don't believe this generation is going to stay quiet. So I think along with that, we should be providing education. Like after World War II, the U.S. required in the constitutions of Germany and Japan that there be education for peace and human dignity. Why didn't the U.S. require that for itself? And part of that had to do with, you know, who wins the war makes the rules, but also a sense of moral superiority. And so I believe education is one of the core ways, but also the drama of protest can be an educator. I think it's a radical form of truth telling. And then when we started truth telling, we were looking at testimony from various truth commissions around the world. And one of the common features was that it presented people's experiences in ways that connected with hearts, making people want to change their society. And that's what truth telling is. How do we connect with hearts that touch minds so that people can be made aware of the conditions that other people live in? Because as we try to market or present messaging for social transformation, we are at a disadvantage. We can't manipulate people the way the current common ideologies or orthodoxies have manipulated people into believing, say, for instance, that, you know, democracy goes hand in hand with capitalism, or black people or indigenous people or this or that. We can't do that. We have to awaken people's minds. And I think people are calling out for that.
David, it's so interesting, this theme that you've touched upon here, because, of course, Gandhi, his term for nonviolence was, or the engaged part of nonviolence, was the satyagraha, so clinging to truth. And for him, truth was a very active part of the process of social political transformation done through nonviolent action. And that we know now, all these years later, that the human being is actually hardwired with mirror neurons in our brains, where when we see someone laugh, we laugh along with them. When we see someone cry, we get sad too. That these are the hardwiring to the software of empathy in the human being. And so in Nonviolent Movements for Change, we do see that telling the truth has this powerful capacity to awaken that empathy within one another, and that oftentimes our movements are vehicles for lifting up the truth of an injustice, what's being faced by communities. Dr. King often spoke a lot about this. And I'm wondering if in your own work with the Truth Telling Project, if you have seen this dynamic play out, that the truth itself becomes a catalyst of changing hearts and minds. I think you've touched upon that briefly, but I'm wondering if there's any specific stories that come to mind that you'd like to share around that.
What I can share is some, you know, stories that are not necessarily connected to outreach and sharing those truths, but internal truths. So the project in Ferguson actually sort of like inspired a spinoff organization in St. Louis, A Conscious Conversation St. Louis. And out of this conversation, the people who came to these like regular meetings were not activists, but mostly black folk. And they are now, based on that, they created all of these projects. Like one group is buying housing to create a co-op. Another group is doing entrepreneurial kind of work. Another group is doing writing. And I mean, I think that what our example has been was that truth can help us empower ourselves. Because number one, when people feel acknowledged, when their stories are acknowledged, and you have people coming together who've experienced some of the same thing, they become interested then in changing those conditions, because they begin to have an analysis. And people already had an analysis. They understand the society that we're living in, and they understand the daily struggles that they encounter. And part of the protest actually, I believe, created a vibrant community of people who are interested and began and are now creating alternative systems to mirror and build the kind of society that they want.
And we'll be back after a quick break for a station ID and your weekly dose of nonviolence. this week's Nonviolence Minute, we're going to look at the tactic of storytelling and truth-telling as one of the many tools that are used in social justice movements. One of the ways that storytelling is used is as a part of the process of relationship building within the movement itself. Sharing our stories is a way of deepening understanding and connection between people who may be working together on a common cause, but coming from wildly different backgrounds. Speaking about our homes, families, life experiences, challenges, and opportunities using a storytelling format can offer a way to remind our fellow organizers that we are all coming from different perspectives, and that those perspectives inform our choices and decision-making processes within our movements. Storytelling can also serve as a form of research in preparation for organizing a campaign for justice. They can help organizers learn more about the community, the injustice, the solutions, the problems, and the possibilities. At the same time, storytelling as a tool of organizing can help break through fear, silence, and isolation, and offer a pathway for community members to recognize their connection to the effort for change. Once a movement gets rolling, storytelling and truth-telling can be used to build allies and to encourage passive allies or neutral bystanders to move into action in support of the cause. Oftentimes, the reality of deep injustice is hidden from the understanding of our society, either through silence and ignorance, or because it is masked under nameless statistics that can be ignored. Storytelling and truth-telling can evoke the human beings, hold up the reality of the lived experience of those who are suffering under injustice and oppression, and offer a way to evoke empathy, understanding, and willingness to take action. One more role that storytelling and truth-telling play is in knowledge building and educating after the struggle. We can use our experiences and stories to make sure the injustice never happens again, and to also pass on the hard-won lessons of movement organizing that we have gleaned from our efforts. By connecting with youth, students, and members of our communities, we can make sure that the things that we know are passed on to those who in turn may need them for the next struggle. As you can see, this is just the tip of the iceberg of ways that storytelling and truth-telling can work for change. If you look carefully at nonviolent movements, you'll see dozens more ways that stories play an important role in the process of waging struggle for justice, dignity, inclusion, respect, and all of the core values of humanity. Seeing the varied ways that storytelling and truth-telling can help our struggles is one of the reasons that we highlight these tools and tactics every week in our Nonviolence Minute. Because if you know your nonviolence, you may find that it is changing your life. And now let's return to our program.
Truth-telling has, I believe, contributed to the conversation around truth and reconciliation, reparations, and restorative justice. Looking at some of the unacknowledged components, such as in restorative justice, one of the things coming out of many practitioners is issues like restorative discipline, which is problematic in looking at what restorative justice is, but restorative justice as this indigenous and often community-based approach that people were already doing. People were already gathering in circles to solve their problems and connect with each other. And also realizing that people who violate the community shouldn't be thrown away. In Chicago, and this isn't connected to truth-telling, but there's a community-based court rooted in restorative justice. And so I believe we've become a part of a national conversation, but also looking at truth and reconciliation, our perspective is critical of traditional approaches to truth and reconciliation, because when you think about both sides, how do you have a dialogue when one side has enormous power in comparison to the other side. And while the point of reconciliation is to bring those two together, those perspectives together, I think we've gone through, like Sherry, you mentioned, centuries of whose perspective is truth. And so we're essentially working to resituate a narrative because truth and reconciliation is often a top-down process. Because the state itself has interest. Even though communities are often empowered, the state itself, like South Africa, had an interest in continuing, and that interest was about business. And as you can see, some of the same material conditions exist. So people are questioning, even youth in South Africa are questioning what truth and reconciliation should be and can be. As Mandela mentioned, it's a long walk to freedom. I know he didn't expect things to change overnight, but I think that part of what we have to do is awaken folk and invite them into the conversation.
I want to go back a little bit to your discussion about racism and capitalism, because I think that that's a really important piece. Malcolm X said you can't have capitalism without racism. And then Richard Wolff in Truthout wrote a really great article about capitalism and racism, where he said racism persists in no small part because its benefits to capitalism outweigh its costs. And that's, of course, in relation to the societal views. And if we go back, if we trace it back, if we start talking about the real history, not the manufactured history that we get in schools, but the real history, racism was the key to the founding of this country. There had to be racism against the native peoples here in order to justify the land takings, the killings of those people. There had to be racism in order to justify the slavery that built this country. And so we have these core beliefs that kind of rooted everyone here. And the two groups that every other that came here had to elevate themselves against in order to find a place within the society was the African American and Black population and Native Americans. They formed the bottom layer of this hierarchy that was built here. We know that other groups came here and they also faced some type of prejudice, but they were able to elevate themselves against, either through religiosity or, you know, some other elevation in status against those two bottom rung populations who this society was built upon, literally. And capitalism certainly isn't the only source of racism, but you can't ignore the correlation at the founding of this country between capitalism and racism without continuing to perpetuate that racism into the future. And so when we look at all of that and we think about this situation that we're in and we think about what you're talking about right now, I've often heard people from my own cultural background, as well as people from the Black community, saying, you know, it's not my role to educate white people. But is that true? I mean, when we start to think about what needs to be elevated, the truth that needs to be elevated, what is our role as people of color to be responsible for telling these truths through uprisings, through social media, through standing together in the streets? We're facing this place where we're talking about, you know, a million people marching on our Capitol, women opposing some of the misogynistic language that was used in this last election. But we're also facing that same urgency in relation to multiple populations of people within our society in order to prevent what appears to be a massive backsliding. And so, how do we tell the truth that needs to be told and not get stuck there, but then also point to and demonstrate ways that we can come together and start building for ourselves the society that we want to inhabit? Because what we feed, what we energize is what's going to grow. Do we just want to energize the conflict? How do we elevate the stories, tell those truths, and then point to, demonstrate, and walk toward something new?
Right. I think that's important. And I would say that in specifically, I'll speak specifically then go generally. In our project, where we've actually taken all of the testimony, and we're in the process of launching an online learning platform that will be available to initially educators and dialogue facilitators and activists and white allies who would like to essentially be able to show testimony to communities. And there's a series of possibilities for lesson plans and learning that people can navigate through on this toolkit. And I'll share information about that with you for your site. But we think that the core part of it is learning. And not that our experience should be up for display, but I think in part, we have to work hard at getting the word out to people about the connections that our oppression and that every American is subject to, and particularly our violent society. And I think part of what we can do as people of color is make connections about what we experienced. You know, like Bobby Seale from the Black Panthers was building a rainbow coalition before he was murdered because he was reaching out to, you know, white workers in rural communities around the country because many communities are taken advantage of. So I think coalition building and connecting our struggles across the board is huge. We have to be able to connect the dots because every American should see a problem with militarized police and National Guard on American streets. That's a core violation of this supposed democracy. And so when we talk about the relationship between racism and capitalism, we see that militarized policing on our streets and in our reservations because those communities aren't valued. And because, for instance, to build, you know, a luxury unit or luxury units for the wealthy is more important than indigenous land and treated land and even deeper violations that go back to the founding of this society. Or the police responding to protests violently, peaceful protests, I might add. And their line of reasoning for that response is often protection of property. So we go back to that founding concept that people of color here, their only value was as property, as objects, to whose land and whose experience and bodies were to be used. And so, like, when you look at the way police operate in our communities now, there's no value in us. There's no value in people of color because of that historic moment and even the initiation of the founding principles that listed Black folks as 3/4 human. So how do you get beyond what took centuries to encode in the hearts and minds of people? I think we're at a point now where all of our issues are coming to the fore. Our land is degraded. People won't have clean air and water to breathe and drink. And the place where that's ground zero is communities of color. Native American reservations and Black communities that we see environmentally degraded through pollution, through locating of plants and processing plants in the most marginal of neighborhoods. We have to find ways and communicate how we're in the same boat. It's not as if one community can't breathe, that's it. You know, it's going to affect the surrounding communities. Or if one city can't drink right now in Pittsburgh, they're finding out that the water has huge amounts of contamination and is just becoming, people are just getting woke, not to mention Flint and Detroit, where American cities that have been essentially forgotten, and this recent Republican Congress has even quietly, according to the Detroit Free Press, closed those investigations into Flint. And then God knows what's going to happen to Detroit beyond the gentrification and the water shutoffs, you know, and violations of special education law in the city of Detroit. We saw like the same financial crisis around that state, but the place where it's hit the hardest is places like Detroit, Flint.
So, David, one of the things that is so important to the Truth Telling Project is the role of taking back the narrative. As you said, that the narrative has been dominated by the media or by the power positions for so long. And it's very important to really make sure that we are reframing that narrative about whose story is being told and who's being believed. I'm curious if you would share with the listeners some of the ways in which you're working to take back that narrative and to reframe it, and the ways that people who are working with the Truth Telling Project are using various forms of media to do so.
Thank you for that question. And one of the things that we've done is right after Michael Brown was killed, we began a series of editorials aimed at like folks that we would normally reach. And we did that through Peace Voice. And Peace Voice lets you write editorials rooted in the basic concepts of values that violence is problematic. And so we did editorials probably biweekly, putting them out across the country. And Peace Voice essentially has a list of over 400 editors, blogs, local newspapers, and people still read their local newspapers. So that's one of the ways. But then we also use social media. And even though that could be an echo chamber, and there are so many different things out there, I think we've cultivated a group of people who pay attention to us, and we're constantly working to enlarge the audience. But then our videos, we have several documentaries where we trained or helped girls actually in Ferguson come up with their own storylines and share their experience and tell their own stories. So in part, that's part of it, but we believe that's just a beginning. And we're involved in three different sort of initiatives that pretty much got feet after this election. One is building a nonviolent national infrastructure of first responders. But also, we've been talking, and I wrote an article in the Huffington Post about what does it look like for us to create an alternative national infrastructure where we respond to each other's needs ourselves. You know, many of the people who were being killed by police, often they were incapacitated or ill or suffering from a break or suffering or living with disabilities that impaired many of their cognitive functions. So part of it is meeting marginalized communities and supporting some of the basic needs that people have. I think we're going to see that we're going to see less and less compassion. I think we're already seeing it. And one of the things that I think about is even this present administration, which is about to be over, there was little talk of poverty, mostly the middle class. And even in the discussions of poverty, which Michelle Obama just spearheaded initiative to support homeless veterans, the only place where you could talk about homelessness or poverty was with veterans. And the co-director of the Truth Telling Project with others in St. Louis has started a homeless shelter for women of color and families and queer and trans folk. So I think part of it is, if we want to change our society, I think we have to do it from the margins. We have to do it from the places most impoverished. And I think we have to educate and support, or educate by example and support communities in getting their needs. And I think that's how we begin changing society, or at least like responding to this narrative.
I think that one of the most exciting things about the time that we're in that many people are looking at with a lot of fear is the fact that we're dealing with a multitude of issues right now. We have, you know, all of these people that are bringing all of their particular issues into this common space. And one of the things that I think is hopeful about where we're going is that we've seen these large scale movements that have helped to shift the hearts and minds of people moving forward. And right now we have the opportunity, I think, to have the largest grassroots movement by starting on the fringes, moving in, which is what I see happening, where people are standing up and they're not saying, no, we're not going to accept this anymore. They're not just complacently sitting aside and allowing for others to be brutalized. They're coming to stand with those who are being targeted and brutalized. And so my hope is that even though within the public narrative, we may be seeing less compassion going forward, that we're going to see an uprising of compassion on the streets. And to me, that's where it happens. And that's what excites me about going forward. And I'm wondering what your feeling is about the coalescing of all of these movements into one unified stand for a more humane and just way of being in relationship to one another going forward.
I think that's possible. I do think that we're moving in that direction. I have worries that much of the energy is going to be taken up by reactionary, at least reactionary to this current or incoming administration. And, you know, I think that it's important to respond, but I also think it's important that we build. So one of the things that I experienced throughout these last 3 years was this kind of movement infrastructure that was created. And some of the infrastructure from the Occupy movement carried over to the movement for Black Lives. And for instance, you know, there are street medics, there are counselors, there are all kinds of folks who've been providing food and all kinds of things and material support needed to sustain movements. And I think we need to shift that to support communities and build communities in ways that are sustainable. And at the same time, I think that the important thing that we can help people who are initially found their activism legs after this election is pull them into the deeper work of the constructive building of ideas and values and behaviors that reinforce building a better society. While we resist, I believe we have to build. We have to be constructive. And for instance, there's a group in Ferguson called Yarn Mission who are essentially selling yarn and teaching people how to knit. I think in one way is a way to bring people together, but as a way to help sustain communities and teach people how to provide for themselves. We see in every area of life in this particular society, I think we see the influence of corporations that don't have the interest of people. And one of the things we have to do, I believe, is we have to get back to the basics of supporting each other and finding ways to connect with neighbors and support what it means to be American, which is welcoming everyone and not trying to send people to other countries because they're immigrants. So the coalitions are important. But as long as we can get beyond the resistance, we have to continue the resistance and build at the same time is kind of the point that I'm making here.
That was a great answer, a wonderful comment to kind of bring in towards the end of our show. I want to remind our listeners that we are speaking with Dr. David Ragland, who is the co-director of the Truth Telling Project. And David, would you let our listeners know where they can go find out more about all this great work that you're doing?
Sure. You can visit us at thetruthtellingproject.org or follow us on Twitter at TruthTellersUSA. That's one word, TruthTellersUSA. Or you can follow me on Twitter, DavidRaglan1. Or you could check out a blog that I'm a part of with other Ferguson activists called We Stay Woke. It's a podcast where we ask activists what they're reading and the ideas that inspire their work. And that's at We Stay Woke. That's on Twitter, We Stay Woke 2K.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, David, for being with us today and for everything that you've shared with us and with our listeners. You're a brilliant commentator on these issues, and we're so thankful to have had this time to talk with you today.
Thank you. It's such a pleasure to be here with you both on this wonderful program. I really appreciate it.
I need you to be love, 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 love and revolution.
Thanks this week to David Ragland for leading us in this incredibly insightful dialogue about truth-telling. And thanks to my co-host, Ms. Rivera Sun. Our theme song, Love and Revolution, Words and Music by Diane Patterson, is also performed by Diane Patterson and Spirit Radio. You can find more of her great music at www.dianepatterson.org.
And thanks to my co-host, Sherry Mitchell, for her comments on the show and bringing together the complex issues that all intertwine to make the injustices we face today. Always appreciate the depth of your insight into the interconnection of all of our issues. You know what, listeners? The other place that you can find more of her in-depth insights is on her Sacred Instructions Facebook page. You can find the link to that on our Love and Revolution page and on the podcast. Love and Revolution Radio is a weekly radio program. Local radio stations across the country have been picking up the show, and it's very easy to get this broadcasting in your area. You just gotta go and ask your station manager. You can reach us via our Love and Revolution Radio page on my website, www.riverasun.com, and we are Love and Revolution Radio on Podomatic, Stitcher, and iTunes.
For Love and Revolution Radio, I'm Sherry Mitchell. This week we heard from David Ragland of the Truth Telling Project. Truth is the gateway to reconciliation. In order for us to reconcile our violent past, we must be willing to tell the truth about our shared history. At the same time, we have to vision, demonstrate, and hold forth a new image for the future. As we move through this movement of movements, we encourage you to find a way to vocalize your truth, and to then reach beyond your individual movements to break down the barriers that have kept us divided. Perhaps you'll take some time to consider the truth that you have to tell and find a way to tell that truth in a way that fosters greater understanding by the time we talk to you next week.